You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, Ben Mathis here with just a quick announcement. If you enjoy this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes and support the podcast by donating to our annual fundraising drive at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the show. Hi there, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. When you hear the term neoconservative or neocon, odds are my guest today will be one of, if not the first name that comes to mind. He's Ambassador Paul Wolfowitz. But as I find out today, he's not too crazy about the term neoconservative, and he explains why on the podcast. But first, let me give you a little background on my guest today. After graduating from Cornell University, Paul Wolfowitz received his Ph.D. in political science from the University of Chicago. While there, he took courses from the political philosopher Leo Strauss, who instilled in him a lifelong belief that democracies, and the U.S. in particular, have a moral duty to oppose tyrants and encourage freedom around the world. He served six U.S. presidents, beginning with Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan, for whom he worked as State Department Director of Policy Planning, and then as Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, where he promoted peace through strength against the Soviets, a tougher stance with China and support for Taiwan, and fostering democracy in places like the Philippines. He then served as ambassador to Indonesia, where he was praised for promoting development, including healthcare, agriculture, and private sector expansion, as well as advocating for political and economic reforms. Continuing on in the administration of President George H.W. Bush, Wolfowitz was Undersecretary of Defense Policy to Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney. Following the 1991 Persian Gulf War, he drafted the 1992 Defense Planning Guide, now widely known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine, which called for unquestioned U.S. military superiority, preemption, and, when necessary, unilateral force. After serving as Dean of the Johns Hopkins School of International Relations, he returned to public service as Deputy Secretary of Defense to President George W. Bush, and he became a pivotal figure in shaping America's post-9/11 foreign and defense policies. In 2005, President Bush nominated Paul Wolfowitz as the president of the World Bank, which is comprised of five international organizations that make up the largest development bank in the world. Wolfowitz made his fair share of enemies there, calling out the world's dictators as the largest impediment to fighting global poverty, and insisting on greater accountability and corruption reform, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, Paul Wolfowitz is chairman of the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he continues to work on development and national security issues. And on today's podcast, we'll talk about his hatred of dictators and authoritarian regimes and how that's shaped his lifelong passion for promoting freedom and fighting corruption. We'll discuss both wars in Iraq and how a cynical attempt by Saddam Hussein to manipulate his own people may have sown the seeds for ISIS. We'll discuss Paul Wolfowitz's time as ambassador to Indonesia and how that country, with the world's largest Muslim population, is a good template for democracy and reform in the Muslim world. He'll share some great advice he got from Secretary of State George Shultz. He'll express his concerns over the Iran nuclear deal and North Korean missile tests. And the world's most famous neoconservative will tell us why he doesn't like the term neoconservative. Coming up with Ambassador Paul Wolfowitz in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Today I'm joined by former United States Ambassador to Indonesia, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense, former President of the World Bank, and a neocon's neocon, although apparently we've established that he does not care for the term neocon, Paul Wolfowitz. Thanks for sitting down with me.
I promised you I'd explain to you at greater length why I don't like it. And here's a short version. It means something when it's applied to domestic policy. It describes a way of thinking that recognizes that conservative policies are actually the way to achieve liberal goals, that if you want to reduce poverty, if you want to improve social conditions, that you need to rely on market mechanisms, you need to think in a way that conservatives comfortably think rather than thinking in terms of government providing all the solutions, which was the war on poverty idea. In some ways, you could say it was a reaction to the war on poverty. But when it comes to foreign policy, it gets applied to anybody who basically follows the foreign policy of Harry Truman or Ronald Reagan, neither of whom are commonly described as neoconservative, but they were people who believed in peace through strength and the promotion of freedom as core parts of American foreign policy and national security policy. And I think I object to the label that suggests it's some strange, novel, new idea, even perhaps vaguely foreign idea, when in fact it's really core American foreign policy, has been in many ways for 50 years.
Well, you once described yourself in your youth as a former aspiring mathematician turned policymaker. What was it that turned you on to world affairs at a young age?
Well, I was my father was a mathematician who was very anxious that I would, if not be a mathematician, at least be a theoretical physicist. You have no idea how snobbish mathematicians are. Experimental physics doesn't count. It's got to be, you know, the Einstein pure theory kind of stuff. And for a while, I had to prove that I could do it. So I majored in math and did a second major in chemistry. I actually had the privilege of working with a Nobel Prize winning biochemist. That was part of the experience that actually persuaded me. I wasn't cut out to spend hours and hours in a lab. It wasn't wasn't what fascinated me. And I began to realize that when I had spare time, I didn't do extra math problems or extra chemistry lab tests. I would read about politics and history. That was what really fascinated me. And I thought, well, it's true political science is not a science, and it's pretentious when it tries to be. But there is such a thing as studying politics and having some deeper knowledge and understanding. I thought, let me give it a try for a year. And I applied to Harvard and Chicago for political science and MIT for chemistry, decided to go to Chicago for political science. And after a year, I didn't change. I have no regrets whatsoever.
Well, early on, you served as an aide to Democrat Senator Henry Jackson, who influenced several neoconservatives, not that we're using that term anymore. he was a
Sorry to make you self-conscious.
No, he was a Cold War liberal, kind of in the mold of a Jack Kennedy, who supported higher military spending and a hard line against the Soviet Union. Does the Henry Jackson breed of Democrat even exist anymore?
There was one. His name was Joe Lieberman, and he was expelled. Yeah. He actually ran for vice president, as you remember.
Yeah.
He basically was expelled from the Democratic Party, had to run as an independent to get elected the last time as senator from Connecticut. So unfortunately, I don't see them there anywhere, and it's not good for the country. I'm afraid the politics of the 1970s sort of killed them off. Jackson was one of the last survivors, and Lieberman, I'm afraid, was the last.
Was that the reason you became a conservative?
Well, it was the reason I became a Republican.
Okay.
I figured it.
Getting into semantics over another word now, too?
Sorry.
So you became a Republican, but did you consider yourself a conservative then?
It's a great question you've asked. Somewhere along the way, I did come to think about myself as a conservative, and not just a foreign policy conservative, but a conservative in a more general way. Maybe I got a large dose of Milton Friedman economics at Chicago. That certainly helped.
In addition to Milton Friedman, then, you're also an adherent of the philosopher Leo Strauss, who believed that we had a moral duty to oppose tyrants. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I've always liked about you is that, unlike a lot of people, throughout your career, you have been rigidly consistent in your advocacy and encouraging democracy around the world. Do you feel that we get ourselves in a sticky position and perhaps even fuel a more cynical view of America when we get in this game of supporting freedom and democracy only when it's convenient for us?
Actually, I do. I think it's Hippocrates said about medicine, above all, do no harm.
Yeah.
And I think if one is promoting democracy, one could also say, above all, do no harm. And I think one could argue that in the 1970s, one can debate the facts here, but I believe that we weakened the Shah and helped to bring in a government that was even more repressive than the Shah. And we weakened Somoza in Nicaragua and brought in a communist government that was even more repressive. And that's not promoting democracy. That's just hurting your friends. And I'm very proud of the fact that when I was working for Ronald Reagan, we did a great deal to promote democracy, not just in the former Soviet Union, the former Soviet Empire, but in the Philippines, where we're almost exactly the 30th anniversary of Marcos's departure in 1986. The following year, South Korea went democratic. The year after that, Taiwan, I think with some American encouragement, became the first Chinese democracy in history. And we've seen Chile is another example, I believe, of a case where Reagan put a lot of pressure on what was supposedly one of our dictators to give way and make room for a democracy. And by the way, I do believe the important goal is not elections. The important goal is freedom. Democracy is a means for achieving and preserving freedom. But freedom is the real goal, and the denial of freedom is the most fundamentally horrible violation of human rights.
Well, yeah, and you have plenty of countries that have elections, but not necessarily freedom.
You can have that,
well, unfortunately. You see the same name on the ballot
two times.
Yeah.
With a 99% return.
Yeah. Vote for Castro or vote for Castro. Yeah.
I think the real test is whether people are free and in a religious sense, free in a when it comes to expression, and free when it comes to thinking about things and promoting ideas.
In your career, have you run into a pushback at times from, I guess, the more realpolitik, Henry Kissinger wing?
I would say definitely in the first Bush administration, George H.W. Bush, I think there was a sort of pushback from people who thought that, let me put it this way, did not want to support the rebellions that started in Iraq after we liberated Kuwait in 1991. And I think they thought they were being tough guys and being, you know, unsentimental realists. And the truth is that they were being unsentimental unrealists. And we've lived with the problems that were created among the Shia in southern Iraq by the fact that we abandoned them. We're still living with those problems today. And we'll be living with the problems of abandoning the people of Syria 20 and 30 years from now. And yet this administration in Washington, this president, pats himself on the back for his so-called realism for not getting involved in that. We're involved in it. It's going to involve us for a long time to come.
Yeah, and
non-involvement, unfortunately, is a kind of involvement.
Oh, yeah. And to your credit, you were one of the guys, perhaps one of the few guys, who was calling Saddam Hussein a thug back when not a lot of people wanted to do that.
I think that's, unfortunately, there weren't enough of us.
Yeah.
And by the way, at that time, there were some Democrats doing it as well. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that's changed.
Yeah. Well, your former boss, George W. Bush, called for more freedom and transparency during his administration in the Middle East. In the sense of what we're talking here, Perhaps he was a little ahead of the curve on that one, because we did see that happen with the Arab Spring a few years later. A lot of people criticized the Arab Spring because in some cases, sort of like we were talking about, it led to some what I would call quote-unquote suboptimal outcomes.
Certainly did.
If America wants to remain the beacon of hope in the world, is it just going to be necessary that we accept that we may not always love the result?
It's a great question. Yes, for sure. But I think it's also important to try to figure out what things we did right and what things we did wrong, so that we maybe increase the chances of getting the right result. Mm-hmm. And I would say in the case of Egypt, one of the reasons Egypt collapsed in the way that it did was because it all happened so suddenly. There had been no gradual opening up of the society. Indonesia, where I was the ambassador for 3 years in the 1980s, right, and in the 1990s managed a remarkably successful transition to democracy, had a much more open society, even though Suharto was a dictator. But there was a press that was prepared to become a free press once the handcuffs were removed. Political parties, they were sort of phony. I used to think of them as a joke back then. But they've become the foundation of real political parties in the post-Suharto era. There was a flourishing civil society that was not interfered with by the government. In Egypt, on the other hand, if you even had the temerity to run for president, that was considered an offense by Mubarak. And he put this liberal Christian Ayman Nour in jail on trumped-up charges precisely because he had tried to run for president. So when you do that, the only alternative that's left is the mosque, and you end up with the Muslim Brotherhood thriving, which is a dangerous thing.
When you were ambassador to Indonesia, you know, more recently we've seen it as a hotbed of terrorism. Did you see any sign that that could eventually emerge as a problem there?
Let me start by correcting the record on the current situation. I think a lot of people hear that it's the largest Muslim country in the world, and then they conclude it must be a hotbed of terrorism. And the truth of the matter is, by the way, to begin with, strictly speaking, it's not a Muslim country because Islam is not the state religion.
Right.
They recognize six religions as official religions. More importantly, the Islam that is practiced there is, for the most part, a very tolerant version of Islam. It really does live up to the people who want to say it's a religion of peace.
Oh, really?
And their efforts against terrorism have been extremely effective, partly because most of the population does not sympathize with the terrorists. On the other hand, if you have a country of 250 million people, 220 million of whom are Muslims, it doesn't take a very large percentage to produce some who go to the Middle East and do bad things, and some who come back. But I would say on the whole, it's a problem that's not growing, it's declining.
Okay. So and the Bali attacks were perhaps
The
a
Bali
lone
attacks
incident.
Produced a huge backlash against terrorists because people realized what these SOBs are trying to do is destroy the tourism trade that we live off of.
Yeah.
So it was seen as what it was, which is an attack on Indonesia. And in a more recent episode, I think this was 3 years ago, as I understand it, when they set off suicide bombs in two hotels in Jakarta, the police not only had no trouble tracking down the ringleaders because nobody was prepared to hide them, they were then shot while resisting arrest, I guess is what you call it. And apparently they couldn't find a Muslim cemetery in Indonesia that would accept the bodies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. So in your mind, Indonesia is kind of a template for civilized Muslim societies in the 21st century.
I think it can be. It absolutely can be. And it's one reason why I'm so happy to see that they're doing well economically and doing well politically.
Yeah. Well, speaking of terrorism, you were the Undersecretary of Defense on 9/11. What was your day like on 9/11? Were you there in the Pentagon when the plane hit? What were you doing?
I was in the building when the plane hit. Rumsfeld put two and two together, immediately got four. He realized we'd been hit and went down to the south side of the building where they were, and he was helping to carry stretchers for a little while until people told him to stop. I naively felt the building shake and thought maybe it was an earthquake. I didn't put two and two together.
A lot of earthquakes in D.C., huh?
Well, actually, amazingly enough, yeah, occasionally there are some. I was actually at a funeral for a Navy SEAL who was killed in Afghanistan, and there was an earthquake during the funeral, and everybody thought, oh my gosh, it's terrorists. It was the opposite.
Wow.
But Rumsfeld and a small group of us ended up in the National Command Center, and there was an acrid smoke that was filling the building, I guess from the fire on the other side, other end of the building. And I said to him several times, you really should get out of here. And finally he said, no, you should get out of here. One of us has to stay, and I'm staying. So he's the boss. So I got sent to this command center up in Maryland, which was designed for surviving nuclear attack. It was really a relic of the Cold War, and a relic in many ways. The furniture looked like it had been bought in 1955, possibly. So, and the communications up there really needed a major overhaul, which I think they have since gotten.
Did they still have rotary dial phones?
almost. But I really felt like I was completely out of it. So by the end of the day, I got permission to come back.
Now, I'm curious, is that place still operational, or have they, you said it was so antiquated, I assume they must have had to update it since
it was
then, or move somewhere else.
In anticipation of, you know, different kinds of disasters.
Location.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Paul Wolfowitz. Back in just a moment. Hey, folks. Do you like reading, but find it harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work, or working out at the gym, or relaxing in the bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics, then be a part of what I'm doing here and help us raise our production budget for 2016 by donating to our annual fundraising drive at GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. Or click on the donate button on our website at KickAssPolitics.com. Thanks for listening. And now back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking with the former president of the World Bank, Paul Wolfowitz. So, Paul, you've been credited as the chief architect of the Bush Doctrine. In the age of ISIS, where do you feel we have to draw the line on what is acceptable preemption?
I mean, I don't consider myself the architect.
I figured you were going to take exception with that.
Sorry to be picking nits here.
I figured.
But, yeah. I mean, if things had been done my way, they would have been done very differently. But I do believe that one of the things that was central here, and I think it's correct, is when you've seen what terrorists can do with an airplane full of gasoline, then you really have to start to worry about what they might do with a truck full of anthrax, for example, which was a real scenario that we, after those anthrax letters appeared in just 1 week after 9/11, we spent quite a bit of time thinking through scenarios of what would happen if, for example, you filled a panel truck, meaning a small van, with anthrax powder and drove around the Beltway of Washington just spraying that in the air. And one scientist who was an expert on bioterrorism told us you could kill tens of thousands of people, maybe even hundreds of thousands that way.
Yeah.
And one of the problems with the anthrax is that you can use antibiotic against it, but once the infection is manifest, it's too late. So we started a very extensive program called BioShield that would have allowed us to detect anthrax spores in the air before people were infected. We took it very seriously, as I think we had to. So I think it was correct to say countries that sponsor terrorists and use terrorism as a weapon, that also have weapons of mass destruction, are particularly dangerous in this era. And you used the word preemption. I mean, one of the reasons I thought, and many people thought, Iraq was the first test of this, was it was not preemption in the case of Iraq. In the case of Iraq, you had, depending how you want to count them, a dozen UN resolutions requiring that they disarm. You had a long record of them lying about what they had and being discovered red-handed. And then for 5 years, since 1998, there had been no inspectors at all. So there was every reason to worry that if anybody was likely to be handing these things over, it was this guy. And there was a strong international legal basis for taking him seriously.
Well, I mean, you know, he did plot to try and kill a U.S. president. I mean, if that's not an act of war, I don't know what is.
It is an act of war. And, you know, I've often thought that maybe if the then president had not been the son of the man Bush who had been targeted, we would have said more about it, because not only is it an act of war, but stop and think about this for a minute. Bill Clinton, actually, shortly before he was inaugurated, told Tom Friedman of the New York Times, and I think this is almost the direct quote, "I'm a born-again Baptist. I believe in deathbed conversions. If Saddam Hussein wants to mend his ways, I'm prepared to do business with him." And that was more or less the quote. And actually, at first, the White House tried to deny that he had said it, but Friedman produced the tape, so they had to. So that was on the record.
That's good.
So in the face of that sort of olive branch being offered, what does Saddam do? He tries to murder the previous president. Mm-hmm. To me, that says either the guy is so obsessed with revenge that he's dangerous, or it's so important for him to demonstrate to his own people that he's a powerful guy who's still fighting, and that makes him dangerous.
That's dangerous.
In either case, the motivation was a scary motive, and it was an act of war.
Could you have imagined what we're seeing now with ISIS back then?
You know, something I think that there were quite a few things our intelligence people missed, and they were not only wrong, everybody knows about stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, but there were a lot of things they didn't know about what Saddam was doing. And one of the things it turns out he was doing, and he started this in 1986, was something called the Faith Campaign. The Faith Campaign was an effort to use radical Islam, specifically Salafi Islam, as a way of mobilizing his population and getting them to hate America instead of hating him. Huh. Because the country was doing very badly. 86, as you may remember, was halfway through this very, very bloody war with Iran. Yeah. And the Iranians were saying Saddam is a, you know, evil heathen infidel. So this was his way of embracing Islam. And one of the things he did right after his defeat in the Gulf War, of course, he said it wasn't a defeat. He said it was a great victory. He had Allahu Akbar inscribed on the Iraqi flag. It hadn't been there before. So there was a steady turning toward religiosity. And many of the people, I think, who were indoctrinated in the use of Islam by that campaign have turned out to be in the leadership of ISIS.
Interesting. So this might have been one of the unintended consequences of him trying to save his own hide.
I think it, in fact, I think there's a, in the documents that have turned up, I think there's a warning from his, I guess it's his half-brother Barzan, basically saying this is a monster that you may lose control of. It may come back and bite you.
Wow. Well, didn't he? He's long gone, and now he's left us to clean up the mess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, knowing what you know now with the weapons of mass destruction and ISIS, would you still say Saddam had to go?
I have to tell you my reaction when, right after 9/11, Saddam was the only world leader who did not condemn the attacks. The only one. Kim Jong-il of North Korea condemned them. The Taliban leadership in Afghanistan condemned them. That's something that may surprise you, but they said this was a terrible thing, but you have no proof that Al-Qaeda was responsible. Saddam not only didn't condemn them, he said basically in an open letter to the American people, after what you've done to the rest of the world, particularly after what you've done to Iraq, you have this coming to you. I'm paraphrasing loosely. And I think he then said, until Americans suffer the way they made others suffer, your government will not choose the right policies. So to me, that made him dangerous. And my immediate reaction was, we have to immediately, not after a year and a half, we should demand that the inspectors be allowed to go back in. We should demand that he hand over the three top terrorists that he was harboring. If I'd waited another couple of weeks, I would have said the four top terrorists, because one of them was Zarqawi, who was the father of ISIS, if you remember.
Yeah.
And if he didn't do that, and then the question is, what would you do? And my answer would be, I wouldn't go to Baghdad. That may be too ambitious, and we've got Afghanistan to worry about. But if you think about it, southern Iraq, which is overwhelmingly Shia and hostile to Saddam, is 60 kilometers from the Kuwaiti border. we could have easily established control. It seemed to me, maybe I was wrong, but I think we could have easily established control over southern Iraq and used that as a bargaining tool to force his departure or to force a coup. So
Who's to speculate? I know that's such a hard question to ask.
Here's one of the problems with Monday morning quarterbacking,
you know.
Well, people say if you knew now what you knew then. I mean, if you knew then what
you
know
didn't,
now.
So.
Well, you never do, but the point is also one thing you still don't know is what would the world be like if he were still around? And the second part of the question that's missing is, if you knew then what you know now, what would you have done differently? And my answer is, I would not have done nothing. I think something had to be done, but I would not have gone to Baghdad.
Well, after that, you took over as president of the World Bank, and two of your biggest priorities were fighting poverty in sub-Saharan Africa and fighting government corruption. Is it possible to have one without the other?
You mean, aren't the two fights the same?
That's what I would say.
I agree. No, that's why I took the corruption thing so seriously. And it irked me. That's an understatement. It got me very angry when people would say, you know, if 50% of the money that we put in there goes to useful purposes, it doesn't matter if 50% of it is stolen. And I think that's a terrible attitude. There are two things about it. One is that it's rarely just stolen. It's often, for example, in the case of one project that we looked at in India that I suspended and got a lot of criticism for suspending, they were stealing by giving drugs to pregnant mothers that were way past their, you know, stale date, their use-by date. In other words, the way you...
Oh, my God, that's horrible.
It is horrible, right? Or they build bridges that collapse.
Yeah.
So corruption can kill.
Yeah.
And the second thing, which I would say is even more fundamental, is the 50% that's being stolen by corrupt people is making the government as a whole corrupt, and a corrupt government as a whole is not going to serve its people properly.
Yeah, and you know, I've always wondered why that is. You know, you see this in so many cases other than South Africa, where they got rid of the Europeans, they threw out the oppressors, and then they, you know, people who came in as liberators became horribly corrupt and became every bit as bad, if not worse, than the people that they replaced. And perhaps it's similar to, you know, the corruption in Russia that we see today, where you have people who are held back by, are suppressed by brutal dictators, where you don't have freedom, that there is this survivalist mentality that you have to get what you can while you can. It's a, like a Darwinian thing almost, just survival of the fittest.
Well,
I don't know.
There's
I'm,
no
I'm
question.
Curious
I think
how that became so ingrained
in very
in
corrupt societies, I think there is a cynicism that creeps in that sort of, you can't fight it. You might as well go along with it. You might as well get what you can get out of it.
Yeah.
But I also think that in the case of the African countries, one of the things that happened was, first of all, having free money around, whether it comes from oil or comes from the World Bank, is corrupting because you don't have to account to your taxpayers for what you do with it.
Yeah.
I think there was a dose of, we're the good guys because we fought the colonial powers, so anything we do is okay. I mean, you see that everywhere in politics, right? If you're convinced that you're virtuous, then you excuse all sorts of things that you know you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
And I would say one of the things that I found very encouraging when I came to the bank 10 years ago is that an increasing number of African countries seemed to be recognizing the mistake of going down that path. And you were seeing reform taking place in maybe a dozen out of the, even maybe 18 out of the 50 sub-Saharan African countries. Unfortunately, I think some of them have regressed since then.
Oh, really?
Nigeria was promising then, and Nigeria has gone backwards a bit. Rwanda still is promising, but I, much as I admire Kagame, I think he's showing some of the signs of a man who's abusing power and been around for maybe too long in a way.
Yeah. How about Kenya?
Kenya is a real problem, and corruption's a big part of Kenya's problem, actually. Kenya was not one of the promising ones 10 years ago, and it's, I would say it's not doing any better now. Oddly enough, one of the most devastated ones, Liberia, I think has a pretty decent record.
Right.
And by the way, it's a case where the U.S. went in with the Marines, changed the regime, handed it over to African Union troops, and never got credit for regime change.
Yeah.
And by the way, they then elected the first woman president in Africa was the product of a free election in Liberia.
When you were president at the World Bank, you also went as far as saying that they should withhold financial support from governments who don't get their act together and institute corruption reform. Now, that to me, that seems perfectly logical. But at the time, that was very controversial. Why was that? How can you not be in favor of ending corruption? Or what is the argument, the pro-corruption argument?
Well, part of it is this argument I told you that, well, if 50% of it does good, then we don't care what happens to the other 50%. But frankly, part of it is that the main measure of success for an institution like the World Bank is how much money have we lent. They are not around 10 or 20 years later to find out whether the money did any good or not. But they have these...
Hold on. I think I fell out of my chair with that logic just now.
They have champagne parties when the loan agreement has been signed. Literally, they feel it's a big accomplishment. So you're getting in the way of business. Yeah. I suppose there was the same attitude in some of those mortgage pirates back in the, that produced the crisis for us.
Yeah, you know, but it does seem logical to me. It's like, I mean, if we truly want to do good, if you actually care, if you actually give a crap, then this should be something you should be on board with. Not you personally. I mean, people in general.
Yeah.
There's no sense shoveling money into a black hole for all eternity if you actually care one bit about doing any good in the world.
And there was really too much of lending and forgiving. I mean, lending to governments that you knew were not going to use the money well and that you'd end up having to do debt relief later.
Yeah. It is like the mortgage scandal.
It is. And the bailouts afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, what gives you trouble these days? What keeps you up at night?
I guess what seems to me American retreat. I mean, I could talk about the bad guys who are prepared to fill the vacuums that we're leaving, whether it's China or Russia or Iran or ISIS. But I think most of those problems are manageable or solvable if the United States is capable of continuing to play a leadership role. And it's discouraging to me that right as well as left, there's a sort of feeling that all of this is doing a big favor for somebody else and it's not good for the United States. And the truth of the matter is we have been among the major beneficiaries of a world that's relatively stable and that hasn't had the kind of horrible wars that we've had in the past. And, you know, as painful as the Iraq War was, it was certainly painful for me, and it went on way too long. I believe if we had had something like the surge at the very beginning, we'd be looking at a very different Iraq today, and the whole subject would look very different. But we lost 10 times as many people killed in Korea as in Iraq. And today, Korea is a thriving model of what a country can be, politically as well as economically. But we didn't leave Korea because it was an unpopular war. We stuck it out. Eisenhower campaigned against the war, but he didn't campaign to take the troops away.
Yeah.
I think we made a big mistake in pulling out of Iraq, and I don't think it was necessary.
Yeah. And you've been very vocal in your opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. It doesn't look like they've wasted much time before they started ignoring it after they signed it. Can we undo that damage at this point, or is this our new political reality? How do we roll that back? If we win the White House and get someone who's willing.
I think it's going to be much harder to roll back than I'd like to think. For one thing, you know, it was special circumstances that made it possible to pull together a coalition of countries to impose these crippling sanctions. There's a lot I think that the U.S. can do unilaterally, but it's much, much harder. It's interesting. This was an argument put forward by someone defending the agreement who said, look, all this talk about worrying about whether sanctions can snap back or not is irrelevant because if Iran cheats, snapping back the sanctions is not going to have an effect soon enough to make a difference. So the conclusion is the only thing that's really going to enforce it is the use of force.
Yeah.
So Obama's actually left us with more reliance on force to counter Iran than where we were before, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, very unfortunate. Well, does North Korea concern you? Is it the missile test, is that just posturing, you know, same as his father and his father before him, or should that be a real concern for us?
let's remember his father and his father before him sent some commandos 6,000 miles away to Burma to blow up the South Korean cabinet. They put a bomb on an airliner to blow it up with civilians on board.
Yeah.
They sent assassination squads into South Korea to assassinate the president. So these are not these are not the kind of people you want to have their hands on the nuclear weapon button. I know it's hard to imagine that even somebody as immature and whatever else you want to call him, as Kim Jong-un, would go ahead and do something that would bring about nuclear retaliation. But I think leader like that becomes very dangerous, I think, precisely because he'll get him into a situation, self into a situation where he provokes something that causes him to fear his own future.
Yeah. Is there anyone who was a big influence in your life or anyone perhaps even in history that you looked up to?
Well, my two heroic heroes, if you want to call them that, are Lincoln and Churchill.
Okay.
But sort of a little closer at hand, I mean, I have enormous admiration for Reagan and for Truman as well, and a growing appreciation for Eisenhower, I think, was a much better president than he was recognized at the time.
You are the second person today who's said that Eisenhower is greatly underappreciated.
Really?
Yeah, and the first person was Wesley Clark earlier in the morning.
Oh. We don't agree on much, but we agree on that.
On Ike. I like Ike. We like Ike.
Quite a remarkable guy, actually, and very smart, too. And, you know, he and Reagan both had this quality that they didn't care if people underestimated them.
Mm-hmm.
They realized that often you got more accomplished if people didn't realize how smart you were.
Yeah.
But I would say in terms of very close personal contact, I benefited enormously from the privilege of working for George Shultz when he was Secretary of State and then for Dick Cheney when he was Secretary of Defense. They were both remarkable, and I learned an awful lot from them.
Did either of them ever give you a particular piece of advice that stuck with you?
Well, one thing that I learned from Shultz, and I passed it along to Cheney, and I think he made good use of it, was that it's important, even when you get as busy as a Secretary of State or a Secretary of Defense gets busy, it's important to carve out a few hours every couple of weeks or maybe every month, but a few hours when you put all the decisions aside and just try to think deeply about a problem. And when I suggested that to Cheney, he said yes, and we started these fairly regular discussions about the future of Russia. It was still the Soviet Union at that point. I think as a result of it, Cheney was ahead of the curve when it came to understanding what Yeltsin meant for the future of Russia and for the world. And I think what they both had also was the quality that they were capable of thinking deeply about a problem when it needed it, but they were also capable of going through decision after decision after decision with minimum regrets after the fact. In fact, I think it was Dean Acheson who said about Harry Truman that he wasn't plagued with that most debilitating of emotions, which was regret. Once the decision was made, it was out of his mind. And I think that's probably an important feature.
Yeah, and that is hard to do. That's for
Very hard to do.
Well, Paul, don't call me a neocon Wolfowitz. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Paul Wolfowitz for coming on the podcast. You can keep up with him and his work at the American Enterprise Institute by visiting AEI.org or follow AEI on Twitter at AEI. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And while you're there, recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on your social media. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.